The books we read, both nonfiction and fiction, offer both a retreat from the sometimes confusing and challenging world, while also helping us to better understand it and better grasp all of the knowledge we possibly can that exists within it. Indeed, literature, and really stories of all kinds, help us better understand ourselves, our communities, our histories, the people we know, and people on the other side of the world, and even help us try to make sense of big issues that often have many narratives, and of events happening in the world around us. And with many things we tackle on this program, there's always more to it. Fiction rarely exists in a vacuum, but rather is often in response to social or political struggles. Literary events, too, play a bigger role than simply hearing someone read aloud while standing at a microphone. But especially in a diversely storied city like ours, who is at said microphone matters, just as it matters who is in the audience. Memoir, too, is not simply telling one's own story, but it, also, can be a tool used in response to silenced voices. So as ever, while our topic tonight is the simple and unassuming book, regardless of it being read on a page or on a screen, the topic nonetheless is a rich one, and one with many stories hidden below the surface. Tonight, we're reconvening our annual literary discussion to talk about books we love, books that moved us, Chicago-connected books and their histories, literary events we're excited about, and the importance of different genres of literature. And of course, we'll also take a look at the Chicago literary community and why there's really nothing second city about it. And while we can't possibly fit it all into tonight's show, this Chicago literary program, already our third one as of tonight, it's a love letter to the many writers who make up the literary community of Chicago. Those here now, those yet to arrive, and those now long gone. Each word has built the pantheon that is Chicago Lit. And while plenty of writers have been merely passing through our fine city, Chicago, the city of work, of getting it done, and all without a scrap of pretension, leaves little marks in their work. I'm Amy Guth, and that's all next on the Saturday Night Special on WGN.
Live from the biggest small town in America,
this is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout Mid-America.
Radio, well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
On our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN, you heard the woman. This is the Saturday Night Special, and I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us this evening, sharing part of your Saturday with us. Most grateful to you for that. I hope you're outside enjoying some of this lovely summer weather. Remember, your February self will thank you for soaking it in now, for sure. So tonight on the program, we are going to be talking with members of the Chicago literary community, all about Chicago-connected books, history, literary events we're excited about, and what makes this very writerly world of Chicago work so well. We're going to be talking with historian Max Grinnell about the origins of Lit in Chicago, with Cole Lavalace, who is the founder and director of Chicago Writers Studio, with Rose Lannon, who co-curates the Misspoken Reading Series here in Chicago, and we're going to talk with her about it and other live literary events, and we'll be talking with author and journalist Michelle Wells about the important role of memoir when we talk about including all voices in the conversation. So we'll be right back to get that conversation underway right here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. We are talking all about the literary world of Chicago tonight on the program, and we'll be talking about historical aspects of it. We're going to be talking about live literary events, some fascinating workshops, and really interesting work that's being done right here in Chicago. And we're going to be talking about different genres of work, including memoir, a little bit later in the program. So you definitely want to stick around for that. We're joined right now by Max Grinnell, who is a historian, wearer of many, many hats. Always a joy to have you on the program, Max. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Amy. Great to be on.
Thanks for joining us. Well, so I have to, I had to immediately pick your historian brain when I tackled this topic tonight of the literary world of Chicago, just because immediately when you think about the Chicago novel, there's so many classics that come to mind so quickly. We think of, you know, Studs Terkel, we think of Upton Sinclair, we think of, Sister Carrie, I think is kind of one of the first ones that we think about as being the quintessential Chicago novel. But then we think of more contemporary work too, like, House on Mango Street, and we think of Gwendolyn Brooks and all this really great work. If you had to kind of characterize it, where would you even start with that?
It's a great question. I think it is hard to find you kind of a starting place. I think in the popular imagination, there's so much of that this is been thought of as kind of, a brawny, the city of big shoulders, starting with so many of the works that you mentioned. I think in many ways it defies the characterization. You say, what is a Chicago author or novelist or poet? I think a lot of it is informed in some ways by the built environment, responding to the sound or cadence of the L, the traffic, the people, the vast diversity around you. I'd say that's the only unifying thing there, because we've caught it, gender, ethnicity, age, And I think it's hard to characterize. I'm hesitant to say there's anything in the water particularly that contributes it, other than the kind of the experience of being in the city. I love that you mentioned Sister Carrie, because in some ways this is something that still goes on today, right? Young people coming to the city, Sister Carrie is coming from Wisconsin, and they don't obviously go to Dearborn Street Station because, it's not a train station anymore, but they come in and they're kind of taken with the experience of being in one of America's certainly largest cities and certainly kind of most vibrant cities. So I think you still see that response, and of course, don't need to tell you. I mean, we see so much of it that's happening online, whether it's, it's blogging or other kind of formats. I suppose there are folks doing novels on Twitter. Actually, I'm sure I've seen it. So,
I've definitely seen it.
Yeah. So, that's my thought on like, how would we characterize it? I think in many ways it defies characterization.
I think so, too. I think so. I mean, I would say the community part of it, past and present, I think there is this very kind of scrappy, let's just get it done kind of way that I think when we look at the literary work and communities in particular on the coast, especially in New York, there's kind of a sheen to it. There's a little bit glossier finish there, where I think there's just a, it doesn't matter if it's well funded, let's just do it. Let's just do this for the sake of the work. I think there's that vibe very much in Chicago that has been there for a very long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that's been, I think, a challenge for Chicago, really starting after World War II, same thing related to other cultural products. I think of blues right away with the recent commemoration or kind of ceremony for the Muddy Waters mural in the Loop is, again, that migration of big publishing houses and out to the coast. But we're so fortunate to have things like Poetry Magazine, which is founded by Harriet Monroe in 1912 in the then called the Tower Town neighborhood. We might call it River North today. And we're so fortunate to have that with us. And that's one of those, I think, at least for poetry, a real bedrock. And, Belt Publications, they do a lot of great stuff, Curbside Press. So there's, I think, a real resurgence of interest in what some people call the Third Coast publishing and literary tradition.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about this earlier. What I think is so interesting that really It'll be interesting to see how history treats that period when there's a little more distance between it. But it seemed like in the early 2000s, when a lot of publishing houses were struggling, especially independent presses, really struggling with buybacks from distribution houses, and a lot of publishers folded, Chicago was relatively unscathed as compared to work happening in New York, simply because of that kind of scrappiness, because we were maybe not as reliant on maybe we were doing a little too much of it ourselves, but ultimately when in crisis, that kind of worked in our favor and helped us sort of skate through this time. So I wonder later how that will, you know, how the narrative will treat Chicago in the early 2000s in the literary world.
Yeah, I think that's another one of these would be really interesting questions, because the so-called Chicago literary renaissance of the teens and 20s, which was certainly, you know, there was published work going on in Chicago for, 7 years before that. So it wasn't, you know, but later referred to as a literary renaissance, starting in the 40s and 50s, and one that people hold dear to their heart, folks like Carl Sandburg, Sherwood Anderson, and other folks coming through, the kind of the writing colonies around the city. So, yeah, I wonder how the early 2000s, you know, I have to say, too, I was reminded, I don't think it's published anymore, the magazine Stop Smiling. I think they might have a storefront space someplace in Wicker Park. But, kind of, again, keeping that kind of the publication, independent magazine world.
For sure. And, you know, I wonder, too, about parallels with, you know, we lost the film industry that was so much, Hollywood was here, and by virtue of, you know, resistance to labor movements and unionization, we essentially, Chicago created Hollywood by driving people out of the film industry here, and of course to warmer climates with where you could shoot more often outside and things like that. But I wonder too, kind of in that Chaplin era of film, you know, why we were able to hang on to so much of the heart and soul of publishing and literary work when this other very large art form really got away from us in a very large way and moved to the West Coast.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those things that's always intrigued me as well, too, because that was a pretty quick migration, you know, really over a period of less than a decade, folks like SNA, et cetera, studios just picked up for exactly the reasons you say, diversity of climate filming locations, and it's more or less always sunny. So that can, you know, and it can stand in for lots of different parts of the world. I think that those kind of key bedrock places in terms of, you know, monthly magazines, until relatively recently, you know, Playboy, Ebony, Jet, the list goes on and on, is really tremendous. And you know this, I don't know if all the listeners know it, but, you know, there's still so many trade publications that are based, you know, in the city and surrounding area. You know, I'm making up a title, but like HVAC Times or something like that, which people may not
my favorite.
Right. It's, I mean, geez, the latest volume, amazing. But, you know, people may, it's not literary aspersions, but, you know, these put writers to work, and they're still around the city, along with some of the big players that we've talked about.
For sure. I can't help but also think about fiction in general and literary works, narrative nonfiction and fiction alike, how it responds so much to things happening socially and politically. And when you put that in a Chicago context, I immediately, you know, Upton Sinclair's Jungle is the one that stands out to me right away with that one.
Oh yeah, I mean it's funny. I talk about with my urban studies students, and I usually encounter 50-60% of them have read it in high school, and to them it's amazing. You know, the tenor of the time, the changing nature of what happens where in American cities or doesn't happen, and we take them down to the stockyards. And of course, famously, there's just the gate. There's just the gate, and it's you know, they kind of get some kind of starting a conversation about, you know, what was this like then, and having read the book and thinking, you know, what would be the equivalent today? Is it kind of work around, you know, protests about the Fight for 15, Black Lives Matter? So it's really a great way to kind of start a conversation about, you know, there are certainly equivalencies to the stockyards where folks work today. It might be, you know, might be big box retail. It might be another kind of work setting that might provide those kind of challenges. And I think it's great to see the writing and kind of activism around that as well.
Yeah. And I think it's so easy to think of something as being, you know, a book is just kind of a thing that stands alone and kind of exists within a vacuum. But when you look at that book in particular, what, you know, so much happened as a result of that book and so much, a lot of cards sort of started to fall. A lot of people, a lot of conversations were sparked. So while maybe, you know, I wonder again how history will treat it, but I think of the books happening now and how they will later be considered as, oh, you know, that book came out and things started to change. This started to happen because of that book. And I think that's far beyond the borders of Chicago, but certainly, an important thing to consider. I mean, we see that happening on a quicker cycle with investigative journalism, you know, a large investigative series or something. You see laws change, you see regulations, stepped up, you see those things. So it will be interesting to watch that around the latest crop of Chicago work.
Absolutely. And I think, fiction, you know, the jungle is, you know, informed by his 6 or 7 weeks when he came out to Chicago to live. And as he famously declared, as he checked into his hotel in Chicago, he said, "I am here to write the Uncle Tom's Cabin of the labor movement." So, I mean, you know, he's a pretty bold thing to say, especially to a hotel clerk. You know, he really had this, I think, kind of prescience about the work. And you know, it sounds kind of, you know, like a kind of a goofy aside to say time will tell, but I think we will see over time, you know, what will we see in terms of works of fiction around this and full length books.
And do you see works, I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, but do you see works, contemporary work happening right now in response to any number of issues, but labor, since we're on that topic, or any sort of activism right now that you feel like might probably be significant works years down the road?
Well, I think this one's not Chicago centric, but a kind of key social issue of our time. Wesley Lowery, who was a reporter for the Washington Post, wrote about his experiences reporting from Ferguson. So I think, you know, that book has been well received, and has also been kind of, you know, part of that trend, that exciting trend we're seeing in terms of investigative journalism. And, you know, we see it in other places, you know, too. I think, you know, the Tribune's recent series on, you know, Cook County property taxes. The thing I always think about that, and more to your point, is who will be the person who will take that and transform it into using these facts and creating something that is more accessible to a larger audience, which I think is really, really exciting. And I think the jungle does that so well. And of course, Chicago's, you know, political climate is kind of ripe for that investigation.
Right. It's out. Someone take it. Somebody step up and do it. There's so much to do, so much to fix, and so many things to write about. Indeed. Max Grinnell, thank you so much for being with us. Everybody, follow him on Twitter. He's at The Urbanologist, and you can also find him at TheUrbanologist.com. Thank you, Max. Always a pleasure. Thank you for bestowing your knowledge upon us, as ever.
Of course. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much. Have a great night.
All right. Bye.
All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff. And when we come back, we are talking with the founder of the Chicago Writers Studio. So stay tuned for that. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight and sharing part of your weekend with us. Most grateful to you for that. So tonight we're talking all about the literary world of Chicago, which is a very, very important one. It is a thing that is very dear to my heart, and one that we have talked about. Now, this is the third time we have talked about this on this program, because there's so much to work with and talk about and think about when we think about literary things happening in Chicago. And so we welcome back to the program Cole Lavallee, who was on a few months ago talking about the Chicago Writers Studio, which she founded and is the director of. And it is a really, really wonderful community space on the South Side. And welcome back to the program, Cole.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
I'm so glad you came back. Thanks for sharing part of your Saturday with us. Well, so for those who do not know, perhaps, tell us a bit about the Chicago Writers Studio and how you created it and what prompted you to do so.
Sure. The Chicago Writers Studio is a boutique writing center on the South Side of Chicago. And basically what we do is we cater to writers at all levels who want to improve their writing, if it's just for recreation, if they're looking to get published. No matter what level you're at, we're there for you to try to help you figure out what the end product will be. So basically the reason that I started or founded the Writer Studio is because everywhere I went, I was meeting writers, right? If at any point in time, if anyone found out that I had anything to do with writing or a book or publishing, oh, I have a story. My mother has a story. My daughter has a story. And I'm thinking, where are all of these people? If they didn't know, because it's almost like a secret club, right?
It is.
No one wants to admit it until you admit it first. You say you're writing. Oh, yeah, I'm a writer, too. Or I want to be a writer. And there just wasn't a place for these folks to actually figure out how to do what they wanted to do, especially on the South Side of the city. And so I wanted to kind of take it out of, because my entire kind of writing career has been in academia. It's been on university campuses. When I go to writing events, everyone is, you know, has an MFA, you know, from here and a PhD from here. And I know that there are a lot of folks that are just out here with wonderful stories that need to be told that will never get an MFA or PhD in writing. But that doesn't mean their stories are any less important. And so I wanted to provide a place for those folks to be able to get their stories out.
Isn't that funny how, and I totally agree, I have that same experience when you mention writing mm-hmm. to people, they go, oh, I have this idea. And people light up. And I think that's so much just a part of human nature to be, I think we're all storytellers on some level.
We
think in stories. We connect to each other over stories. I think that's such a big thing. And I wish we didn't have it as a secret club. I wish we just knew that about each other, that we were all telling stories, even sometimes to ourselves, and living through stories and recognizing stories in that way. It's such solitary work.
It really is. And I think part of why the folks come to my studio and why they enjoy it so much is I'm giving them permission to say that they're writers out in the public,
yeah.
right? Not in little whispers and dark mm-hmm. corners, but out. And it's an important thing. Confidence is, I want to say, 90% of writing. To think that I have the right to call myself a writer, I have the right to tell this story, it's a big deal.
Yes,
it's a big deal.
Definitely. And I think there's a magical moment that happens for people when they go from saying, I'm trying to write a thing, to I'm writing a thing.
Right.
That is magical. I mean, it seems really minor, but taking the word trying to and just say I am is a moment.
Right. I think I was probably halfway through my third degree when I finally called myself a writer. I'm like, I write. But, you know, I published a little, but, you know, for me, it was something, am I a writer? I finally had to kind of say, yes, I am a writer. No matter what happens, if I never publish another thing, I'm still a writer.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So your book, Summer of Cicadas, when you were writing that, was community a big part of that? Or was that still in the time when you were running into people and everybody was kind of whispering about being a writer?
I'd say a little bit of both. I definitely already had a community at my back, right? I'd gotten my MFA at Chicago State University, and it was such, from the very first day that I walked into class, I felt as if these were my people, this was my family. And so in a lot of ways, even when I was on my trek alone to write Summer of the Cicadas, they were still there. I knew those encouraging voices and those people who said, yes, you can do this. This is wonderful. Keep writing it. Because in the midst of that, I was also, when I was actually writing what ended up being the final version of the novel, I was in a program that didn't feel like community to me, and that everything I was writing was being questioned, you know, consistently. So it was, so I always had that community at my back, but I really did it in isolation. I was, you know, sitting at a table in a coffee shop every day for 6 months, just pounding it out alone.
Well, I think that is an important detail too. You said 90% of it is confidence. I think 10% of it is sitting your butt down and doing the work. A lot of times people have asked me, well, you know, do you have any advice? I'm trying to write this book. And I just say, you just got to sit your butt down and write.
That's
you just got to do it.
That's the second hardest thing I have with my students. For some reason, they think because I'm there to help them, I'm not going to write the book for you, girl. Right. You got to write that. You have to you have to do it. And it's okay if it's bad. It has to be bad first, right? It has to be bad first. So don't worry about that. But you have to put those words next to each other. That's the only way the book is going to get written. That's the only way anything is going to get written.
That's so true. I think there's a lot of power in just getting that first draft out, getting it out of you.
It really is. It really is.
Magic happens after that.
Right.
You can edit it later. Just get it done.
Right.
If you sit there and go, I have to write the perfect sentence, you're never going to get that done. It's going to drive you crazy. So how do you create that culture, and how does that philosophy manifest at Chicago Writers Studio?
Basically, I'm a believer in tough love, right? That I've kind of moved beyond my first two or three class sessions, I would give homework, right? Oh, you have to do this writing outside of class, and everyone would come and, oh, the dog died, you know, I got a flat tire, my boss is a pain in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so guess what? We're going to have to do it in class. So I don't let their excuses get in the way of them actually writing. So now I've really focused more on, we're going to do it all here. You have 20 minutes to put something on the page, and then you're going to read it, and then you're going to take it home and revise it. So I'm really focused on getting them to put something on the page. And so they can't sit in front of me and not write, because start doing something.
Right. Checking Facebook, I'm going to catch you.
I'm going to catch you, right? It's just, we're in a very small space. I can see you. So I'm really focused on just pushing them to get that first draft out. And then we can work on everything later. But if you don't have anything on the page to work on, what are we going to do when you come to class? And you've paid good money to be here. So hopefully.
Very true. Very, very true.
You want to get something done.
Ideal. Right. That's why people are going to a writer's community of like the Chicago Writers Studio. We're talking with Cole Lavallee. She's the author of Summer of Cicadas and the founder and director of Chicago Writers Studio. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to keep talking with her about all the cool, cool programs happening there at her facility and all the cool things coming up next. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thank you for being with us tonight. So tonight's topic, as ever, we just pick one big old topic and just unpack it with the help of our guests. And tonight's topic is the literary community of Chicago. And so we're talking with Cole Lavallee, who is the author of Summer of Cicadas and founder and director of Chicago Writers Studio on the South Side, which is such a lovely place. And I hope you all go visit. You can find out about it at ChicagoWritersStudio.com. And you can see how adorable it is on the website. It's so cute and chic looking. I just love it. And so we were talking a little bit about the programming there and kind of your approach, but I want to take kind of a broader look now, Cole, kind of as you, we were talking a bit about running into people who as soon as you say writer, they're like, oh, I have this story. You know, we were with the last guest, we were talking a bit about history, and we were kind of trying to categorize what is the Chicago writer and what is the Chicago writer community all about? And we really were unable to do it other than kind of a through line of it's about no pretension, and it's about work and the experience and just getting things done. But even that, I think, kind of falls short because it is a city of just, it is such a diversely storied city that I think there's just so much to tell that I think it's almost impossible to say there is a Chicago writer or a type of writer.
I agree with that. I think it's both due to how Chicago is so segregated in a lot of different ways that we don't all live in the same Chicago.
Truth.
And because we aren't all coming from that same that same background, your stories are going to look different. Your characters are going to look different. Your context is going to be different. And so I think it's a great thing, right? That maybe not the segregation isn't so great.
Sure.
But the idea
no
of,
on that.
right. No on the segregation, but yes on the diversity.
Yeah.
That we get these experiences. So when you pick up a Chicago writer, you don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And I think that's important because we're so segregated in the city, that yes, it's a wonderful thing. Pick up a book by, you know, Gwendolyn Brooks, or pick up a book by Cyrus Coulter, and pick up a book by other Chicago writers that you wouldn't normally pick up, because you're going to see a part of Chicago that you haven't probably seen in your daily walk.
Yeah, as you're describing that, and as you're talking, I'm thinking immediately of that very popular TED Talk that Chimamanda Adichie gave about the danger of the single story.
Right.
That I think is so spot on for this. And in it, she's describing how she did not see herself represented, and she had kind of this single narrative of what a character in a book was, because she was only reading about children in English literature, where she said they talked about the weather and they drink ginger beer and all these things. And she said, we'd had no reason to talk about the weather in Nigeria. And I think that's such an important point too there, because indeed it's not all the same Chicago.
Right. And just the idea of the single story, that a lot of writers of color get put into those boxes, right? Because you haven't, oh, this is such a wonderful story and we have never read this story. Now everyone in, thinking of Juno Diaz's book, now every Dominican, this is their experience. Well, no.
Right.
No. Right. But because we don't read more broadly and we don't get those stories, kind of not all of those books are going to be on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah.
Then we don't see those diverse experiences. But there are a lot of writers of color that are writing all across the board, not just in Chicago, but all over the country. And it's important for us to kind of read more broadly. Say read harder. Right?
Read
we
harder.
Have to read harder.
That should be a shirt.
It is. I have one.
Do you?
Book Riot. I want to say bookriot.com.
I'm writing that down.
Yes.
Book
read
Riot.
Harder.
Read harder.
Mm-hmm.
My birthday has already passed, but I'm going to figure that out. Okay. That's lovely. I love that. Well, and two, I think a lot of times the concept of intersectionality falls very short when we're looking at literature, because I think that sometimes, you know, you think of, oh, the Chicago writer is this like white guy it's Studs Terkel who's talking about working hard.
Right.
It's that. And indeed, there is this scrappy quality, I think, to a lot of Chicago work. But when you look at a book that is by a writer of color, it doesn't need to be about that person's race. And
right.
I think that narrative still comes up so much that, like, even on different level, like, I wrote a book in 2006, and someone specifically was like, well, how come your characters weren't Jewish? I was like, well, that's just one part of me. Like, that's not all that I am.
Right.
Right? And I think that narrative comes up a lot too, that like only white guys can write about anything.
Right.
But everybody else has to write about just this one thing that defines them as not being a white guy.
Right. Right. And then you're also categorized right there. You get the publishers who's like, oh, we had a book by, a black lesbian last year. Need another one, right?
Right.
Huh? Like, could you imagine if they're like, no, we had a book by a white guy last year. We don't need that. Would
Can
never
you imagine?
Happen.
Right.
That would never happen. So it's kind of the publishers are working against you. You have to work for yourself, because the publishers, especially the big publishers, are working against diverse reading. And so you have to kind of really be a detective and go out and kind of search for these independent press, because they're out there. The writers are out there. The independent publishers are out there, and they're doing this work.
And there are many in Chicago that are doing really interesting work. And I always try to support them so much, because I want them to win. I want them to thrive.
Right.
And I feel like sometimes we lose such good work to people like, oh, well, now I got to move to New York to be a serious. No, you don't. No, you don't. You can stay here.
You can stay here.
I feel like people come here, they improvise, they do like classical theater, or they write, and then they leave.
Right.
No, you can stay and do all of those things here. And more and more, I have greater hope in small Chicago presses and the work that the community is doing in Chicago. And And I have to believe it's going to win. It's going to work, because I think that is very important. I think still kind of gatekeepers of power in those big houses kind of have, sure, they could throw $1 million at a book and market the bejesus out of it. But I think there is something really kind of magic about a book publisher right there in your city, especially if it's in a community you are from, that I think is very powerful. Like, I think it's important when you are working on a book, you do have to let go a little bit. You can't flip out over your edits, but I think it's also really important, an editor that gets you and hears you and understands that. Just, I think that matters.
It really does. Working with editors from, you know, essays to short stories to the novel, the process is so, because we do it in such isolation and we're kind of God, writers are, you know, they're God, and we are going to put what we want on the page. So that relationship with that editor has to be one of mutual respect and trust. If you don't trust your editor, then you're going to be angry throughout the entire process.
It's not going to be fun.
It's not going to be fun for either one of you, right? And so it's important. I think that's a good point, because I think we need to develop not just writers, but there need to be more folks who are on that side, more editors of color, or maybe not even of color, but more editors who've experienced something more than this kind of homogenous publishing world. And I remember when I first was sending my book out to be published, and I was getting a lot of agents that went, oh, I didn't really love it. And it's mostly women, white women agents who didn't love it. And I kept thinking, what does love have to do with it?
I don't care if you love it. Can you sell it?
Can you sell it?
That's what I want to know.
I didn't understand this whole kind of language of love around this business. I'm like, do you have to love Cadillacs to sell them? Can you sell a Cadillac without loving it? Is that possible? So I started to kind of think about, well, what does that mean if they don't love my book? Is it because it's not speaking to them? Is it because that this particular subject, they feel outside of it, and so it's difficult for them to love? Because I don't need you to love it, right? I need you to
sell it.
Yeah, go sell it like
sell
the wind.
It. Sell it. Sell it like the wind, right? And whenever I kind of bring that up, even to writers, they're like, but no, it's so difficult in the publishing, and they have to really be behind it. You can be behind a project and not love it. You can know that there's an audience out there for something. You might not be it personally, but this is a story that's unique, and that audience needs it. I still don't understand what love has to do with it, but I guess.
Right. Indeed. You're so quotable. I'm sitting here writing down all the funny things you're saying. I've got, I'm definitely going to tweet this out as an overheard on WGN Radio, where you said, we had a book by a black lesbian last year. That's the first one. Second one is, you don't have to love a Cadillac to sell it. No, you do not. I love it. You're very, very quotable, Cole Lavallee. So tell us, what is coming up at Chicago Writers Studio that we should definitely not miss?
We have so many great classes coming up for the summer. We have our screenwriting. We have moved into, now we're doing a screenwriting workshop with the wonderful Shahari Moore. She will be doing, this is in August. So if you have the first act, or if you have your complete screenplay, she will be workshopping that first act, act one. And it's going to be fun. Shahari, the first class of students, because the studio is so small, right, and I'm there, and it's kind of, I just ear hustle like the whole time. So they're over here. I heard their stories from kind of the first week to week eight. And it was amazing kind of what she did with those, how she helped them to find their intentions in their screenplays and get it to a place where I was just like, I can't wait to see all of these on film. So she's, if you can, I'm telling you, get down. If you want it to write, if you're interested in moving your screenplay forward, that workshop is one I wouldn't miss. And then I know last time I was here, you asked me about, you know, doing something for young people. And I was just like, no, girl, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, I recall.
But, Never speak in absolutes, because I am doing something for young people. So many parents reached out to me and they were like, are you doing anything for kids? I'm like, no. And so, especially on the south side of the city. So we are going to do two workshops for kids coming up in July, August. One is a storytelling workshop, which I'm really excited about. We just started our storytelling workshop for adults last week, and Lizzie Dzinski is wonderful. She's done a lot of stories with Second Story, and you can find her podcast. She's a wonderful storyteller and a wonderful teacher. So she's going to be, and that's really her passion, kids. She kind of talked me into that. I brought her in for adults, and she's like, but I really want to do something for, and I was like, okay. So she's going to do something for the kids. And we're also going to do a spoken word workshop with Tara Betts, who is just wonderful, wonderfully talented poet. We're so we are so lucky to have her back in Chicago. And I was trying to drag her in here tonight, but of course she's out in LA doing her poet
being
thing.
Being fabulous.
Yeah. And so she's going to do a spoken word workshop for teens. So in both the spoken word workshop and the storytelling workshop, it's going to culminate into a recital sort of where the kids will get to perform what they've worked on through the summer. So it's going to be, I'm really excited about those to see how they work out because, you know.
New thing, new territory.
You're right. Doubting Thomas to see, you know.
Right.
How it works out.
Lovely. Well, everybody, head to ChicagoWriterStudio.com to find out about all the cool stuff happening there, to stay tuned for said recital, all of the stuff, to sign up for classes, to visit, all of those things. Cole Lavallee, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a break and get you to news and all that good stuff, and we'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. We got to rock out to that one for a minute. It's a good one. It's not often we get these good jams on this station. Yes. So, we are talking all about the Chicago literary world tonight on the program. And as ever, we pick this one topic that seems really straightforward. And then as we start digging into it, there are many, many layers that we cannot possibly tackle in one program, but good to surface them and good to think about them. So far, we've talked about some historical details and we've talked about some community details. So let us move on now to the many, many, this is one of my favorite things about the Chicago literary world, and that is the many, many live literary events that happen every single night, at least seven times in this fine city. So here to help us do that is Rosamund Lannon, who runs the Misspoken Reading Series, which I have been a part of, and it is very, very fun. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Thanks for being here. I'm so glad you were able to take time out of your Saturday for us.
Oh, absolutely.
So tell us, for those who perhaps do not know, about the Misspoken series and kind of what led you to create it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Misspoken is a Lady Live Lit show. And for those unfamiliar, I'll pretend I'm talking to my coworkers in the lunchroom when I explain Live Lit.
Sure.
We'll just go there. Live Lit is nonfiction personal essays in front of an audience. And the lady part of it, Misspoken, is live lit for the female identified. And, you know, what that means is, you know, female, women, but we're very open to anyone who's comfortable with that label. I've tried for years to find a way to say, you know, non-dude, but but yeah, it is, you know, work by the female identified.
And every month you have a theme, and everybody kind of does that work around that theme.
So we picked a theme at the beginning of the show years ago when I started it with Carly Oishi. We really liked the idea of a theme every month. And not just a theme, we wanted to do kind of feminine themes like boobs.
Sure.
And like other things like that that are sometimes specific to women, though we don't always do that. Sometimes we do kind of more universal themes as well, like jobs or, you know, things that we also may not be female specific, but we wanted women's takes on it. But we feel like having a theme helps because it gets people thinking, it gives them somewhere to get started. And like, I don't know about you, if I just sit down and kind of think into the ether, sometimes I'll just like watch YouTube for an hour, you know. But if I have somewhere to start, I really like having a baseline.
Yeah.
And also the great thing about having a theme is someone is like, oh, I have a great story about that. And that's what we want.
Definitely. I don't remember how you worded the exact theme of the one that I did, probably about this time last year, I suppose. It was summer. But it was, I know that I read grade school diaries on stage?
Yeah. Oh, man. Now I'm trying to remember what it was. This is driving me nuts. It wasn't...
I don't think it was as overt as humiliation, but something like that.
No, definitely. It wasn't Dear Diary, but though I really like that theme. I'm going to think about it throughout the show, and then I'll come back to the one that you did.
And so for the next one in the series, what is the next theme that's coming up for people?
The next theme coming up, which you can see the last Wednesday of the month at a gallery cabaret in Uptown, the theme is munchies. So that is a colloquial term, but we like to see what people do with it. It's going to be about food, and I love talking about food. I think about food all day.
You write about food. You do lots of things.
I do write about food. So we have Lucely Nisley and Sarah Beacon and Nadine Kenny Johnstone. And it's really going to be a great show.
That's going to be an excellent show.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm super excited for that. So let's kind of take a broader look then at Live Lit in general in Chicago, because I'm not kidding when I say there's really more than one thing almost every single night of the week. There are so many things. And I think that's so wonderful about Chicago, is that you can never get bored of all the live lit things happening. But what led you to create Misspoken when there's so many of them already? Were you aiming at, I just want to do something specifically for women, or was it in response to something else?
I started doing live lit shows and I'd been really enjoying it. But I think when I started Misspoken, I did want something specifically for women. That was definitely a big part of it. There wasn't a live lit show that focused specifically on that. And when I say specifically, I think this doesn't mean that it's exclusive. Rather, it gives a broader experience that you don't often get in the media. And I'm just going to kind of go for the belt here. You don't often get in the live lit scene as well. Like many creative scenes, the live lit scene is pretty heavily white and male. And that's not a slam so much as, I mean, it is kind of a slam, but it's the reality of it.
Yeah,
And my joke kind of at the beginning was, I'd rather talk to your girlfriend at a party than you. but really, which is still sort of true, but I really like hearing women's stories, and I think what we have to say is really interesting. And I think a big part of it, especially with the themes, which sometimes can come off, you know, topics that are often considered frivolous, actually have a lot of weight to them. And because they're considered frivolous, that says something too. Like, why is this not important to you? You know, like people would say, oh, makeup, that's silly. But really, the cosmetics industry is huge. It's $1 billion. Like, I'm very interested to see, like, what's behind that? Like, how people paint their faces? Like, what does it mean? And I think women's topics, like many marginalized groups in this country, it's, when someone says it's not important, there's something to gain by saying this isn't important. And I think it's really important. Also, I wanted to have a show of my own.
Also that, for sure. And what I think is so interesting too is once you start going to some live lit events, you'll start seeing kind of familiar faces in them, and you're like, okay, this person is promoting this book, so they've hit all 15 of these in this neighborhood.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's a very like natural way to get out to your audience. And I also think it's interesting to read your work in front of people, because when you read in front of people, it's very different than it's writing for the page versus writing for the stage. And you very quickly get a sense of like what works and what doesn't. And I really liked your piece because it was kind of a you know, it was diary entries, correct?
From like fifth and sixth grade and a couple high school.
Yeah. They were hilarious. And like, I'm sure you framed it a little bit differently than someone just reading it on a book. So you kind of get a chance to test out your material and you can see what people laugh at. And it's a very personal way to engage with your audience. So I think that's really important.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've used it like workshopping almost. I'll try pieces of a longer work and go, well, that didn't work, so I better rework that piece a lot.
Oh, definitely. And there's stuff you think, you know, it's super funny when you write it out. You know, you fall in love with your own work a lot, but then you're like, and you know, people are like, kind of hits a flat room. But on the other side of things, sometimes you're really surprised at what appeals to people, and you just get a good sense. You're very much not creating in an echo chamber when you do live lit, and I think that's super important. It's also just really fun to see an actual flesh and blood person read their work.
Yeah, for sure. And so as you think about other, I'm not gonna ask you to say a favorite because that's too hard and too political.
Oh, I love playing favorites.
Oh, well then let's go.
Let's go.
I was going to say, what are some other series that you enjoy? But if you want to say favorite and the best, let's go.
These are all of my favorites.
All right.
That's why I want to go on the radio. Make enemies.
Sure.
Live lit enemies. So some of my favorites, I really love Tuesday Funk.
Yeah.
And I'm going to name a lot of favorites because I have a lot of love in my heart for a lot of the live lit series.
Indeed. And then you're going to think of like 10 after you leave.
Oh, absolutely.
We'll tweet them.
And then that sounds good. That would actually be great. I really love Tuesday Funk. I think that's a great one. That's run by Andrew Huff and Eden Robbins. And I think that one's great because it's one of the few series that has fiction and poetry. And there's like some flexibility to the format. Another one that I was actually going to bring up earlier when you asked about starting an all-lady live lit series is this isn't live lit, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. It's called The Cates. It's an all-female comedy troupe, and they were the only one I could think of when I was doing it, but I'm like, they're more comedy-based and I'm more personal essay-based, so this is fine. The Cates is fantastic. I laugh very hard.
But, you know, even though they identify as a comedy group, I think they're very much storytellers.
They are very much storytellers. And I actually took, man, this is turning into a kind of whatever. I took Kelsey Huff's class, The Feminine Comique, which I would recommend for anybody, even if you have zero interest in being a stand-up comedian. And there's such an art to telling a story. I think it's very helpful with your pacing and what's funny and like when to pause at a certain time. I mean, you just learn a lot about beats and movement. And again, like what makes stories interesting in front of an audience. I mean, I can read an essay on the internet, but like if I'm going to actually tell it and sell it to people, I need to move my face and my body. And that's something that I think she teaches incredibly well. And also she just has a great attitude and you laugh really hard in class.
Also, she's very, very funny on the internet.
Incredibly
funny. And very funny in person.
She's incredibly funny on the internet. Kelsey, you're very funny all the time.
She is. She's a funny lady.
She is.
Well, and part of that, I think, too, is when talking about sharing things live, there's the pause. I think so many people, like, you get up there and you just want it to be over. The people just don't give it that minute for something to land.
Definitely. And that's something I'm still working on. And I'm going to slow down my phrasing right now. I tend to blast through things, especially when I'm nervous. And that was something Kelsey kind of really taught me is, slow it down. I can't remember the last 5 things you said. And also you want like your lines to settle in with people. You want to hear them laugh, wait, give them a chance to react to it. That's something that I'm trying to learn all the time. And you know, we're all a bundle of nerves. We just want to like blast through our story and get to the point, but give people a chance to work with you, you know?
I think too, what's cool about the live lit world, particularly here, is that it's pretty welcoming. It's pretty easy to get. I mean, it doesn't cost anything. Like no one's making money from them. People are just doing them for fun for the most part. I mean, sometimes there's like a little bit of a cover, but it's not like $50 to go.
Right, right. It's very accessible. So we actually, you know, we do have a $5 suggested audience donation. And so I love talking about money. I write for the Billfold pretty frequently. So I'm going to talk about money and the arts here because I think that's kind of a verboten topic. But we do have a $5 suggested audience donation and it goes straight to our readers because there's something very different between being paid no money and being paid a little bit of money. And this isn't I have no problem with people doing this for free. That's not, you know, what this means, but I'm always glad that that's a part of this. And to what you said before, it is a very accessible scene. You can just get up there and tell a story. Most series welcome most experience levels. There's definitely other ones. And again, this isn't bad, but The Moth that you kind of have to try out for. But for the most part, it's very much an open mic quality for a lot of them. You can go up there and tell your story and you will get an audience reaction and there will be an audience and it's open. And that's one thing I really like about Chicago that I feel differentiates us from other cities. Like it's a scene you can break into you don't have to know the right person, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah, you can. And most of them are in bars, so you can have a cocktail and chill out.
That's very true.
And calm your dang nerves.
Correct. Absolutely.
Indeed. Well, we're talking with Rosamund Lannon. She is the co-curator of the Misspoken series, and we're talking about Live Lit in Chicago. We're going to take a little break and keep this conversation rolling when we get back on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. As ever, we take one big old topic and we talk about it all night long, different pieces of it, different aspects of it. And tonight, that topic is the literary world of Chicago. And so we have been talking about the history and some major, major books in Chicago's writerly world. We have been talking about writerly classes and workshops and events going on. And right now we're talking with Rosamund Lannon. She is the co-curator of the Misspoken series, which is a really, really fun series. I have done this series about a year ago. I did it. It was very, very fun. And I highly encourage you to go. But I highly encourage you to go to many of the many, many live lit events in Chicago, because there, I'm not kidding when I say there's one every night of the week, because there really, really is. That is a real thing. So as we think about the Chicago live lit stuff that's happening, all the things, all the many, many events that we're thinking of and talking about here. How have you seen it evolve just since you've been hosting a series, and because I know you go to so many of them too. How have you seen it evolve, and where do you see it heading right now?
Oh man. So I think in terms of how it's evolved, I guess there's so many of them now, and there's kind of something for everybody at this point. I feel like, you know, no matter what your experience level is, if you want to kind of get into a competition mindset, there's ones that have that kind of edge. There's also ones that are kind of neighborhood specific now too, which I like as well. Because as I brought up before, you know, the live lit scene could be a lot more diverse. And I feel like localizing it to certain neighborhoods, I think kind of like helps accomplish that goal because it makes it accessible. What else? I feel like comedy is intersecting with it more as well. I feel like stand up is really having a long 3 year at least moment right now, with Netflix specials and like everything. And one show that I haven't been to yet, but I'm very curious about, called Ladylike. That's also female identified.
I've heard of that one. I haven't been to it either.
I haven't either, but I'm going to go.
Let's go.
Watch out, Ladylike. I'm coming for you. by that, I mean I'll come to your show. But Ladylike is kind of in the gross out story vein. So that's another thing I think I've kind of seen. Not gross out story veins specifically. That would be weird. But I think they're it's becoming kind of more focused a little bit, whether that means by neighborhood or it has more of a theme. I think it's spreading broad and also kind of narrowing at the same time. And of course, I kind of have that fear of it being oversaturated a little bit as well, because there is a live lit show every night of the week. But I think as long as people want to tell stories, and I think there's still a much broader audience live lit could reach as well. Again, I'm going to give talking to my coworkers in the cafeteria, you know, the lunchroom example. Like, they've heard of The Moth, but if you say live lit, that still kind of requires some explanation. So I still feel like there's audiences to reach and, you know, people to benefit from it. And yeah.
Well, and I think that's something that you do such a great job with Misspoken, because you have the podcast element too.
Sure.
And I think where digital comes in and intersects with all of this, it's interesting. I mean, I've seen people live tweet literary events. I've seen people podcast them. I've seen them Facebook live them. And that's an interesting component that I'm very curious to see how that evolves over time too.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, podcasts are incredibly popular right now as well. There's a lot of storytelling podcasts. So it's interesting. There's kind of we record and we do our show. You can listen to it on iTunes or Stitcher as a podcast. But I'm curious to see what direction that moves in also, that there's an in-person component and kind of a digital component. But I think we're reaching broad, but we're also getting the series are getting kind of specific in some ways or another.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, and so I wish that we had hours more, because there's so much more I want to ask you and talk about. But as you have readers coming in to your series, do you feel like, do you ever see, you know, kind of, I don't want to say to characterize them all, but do you see kind of themes, or do you see ways that storytelling shifts a little bit or responds to events? I'm sure lately, like in this year anyway,
yeah,
it's been more political, I'm sure.
Definitely. I mean, Trump.
Trump.
That's been a big thing. I definitely think politics are influencing it in a huge way that maybe, honestly, they weren't a few years ago, which I don't. I mean, really, this election has made a lot of people wake up. And I think that's seeping into people's consciousness as well. I'm also trying to think of other themes that I kind of see in there. I think I see I don't know so much as I see is what I want. I kind of want to pull readers on the younger and older end of the spectrum in. I think that's something, they're out there, and I'd like to hear their stories a lot, because as much as I like to hear from 30-year-old white ladies, aka myself, I think the whole point of this is you hear different perspectives. And kind of getting back to the Lady Live Lit aspect of it, one of the things that's most rewarding about the show is hearing men who might not think about this stuff at all, after the show they'll be like, oh wow, that's a thing. Especially when it comes to, you know, harassment or just the things that women face every day. I think it opens a lot of eyes about it, and maybe not always funny, but sometimes funny, just accessible way. Like, this is a real person up there saying this. This is a real thing. This isn't just like a remote news item. These are people's personal lives. And I mean, to kind of circle back to like topics that people think are frivolous, or, you know, can be deemed frivolous, people's personal experiences, I kind of think, are everything, because they often point to larger truths. And I'm hoping that's what gets through. Or you might read a news article and you're like, that's terrible. But if you hear somebody actually tell a story about it, it becomes a lot more real.
Yeah, definitely. You know, if I had to pick one thing out of just going to events and watching them over time, I would say they seem a little less... less performed in a certain sense and a little more realistic. I think people are warming up to the idea of being a lot more vulnerable in front of a microphone.
Definitely. I feel like it's, you know, choreographed, but not staged.
Yeah. It doesn't sound rehearsed. It sounds like a storytelling.
Right. Definitely. I think, that's definitely something I have seen. It's not so much I'm reading from my book. It's like I'm kind of giving you a blow by blow of the experience as I was there. And I think that kind of goes into comedy and some other stuff blending into it as well, where you can kind of be a little looser and play with the format. And that's something I look to see change. I'm curious to see how that changes as well. There's definitely a certain sound for some live, you know, for live lift shows that I think I like to see people play with that. Like, yeah. I don't just want to hear, you know, the same format every time. I like to see when people kind of go back and forth.
Definitely. Well, everybody, you can follow Misspoken Shy on Twitter. Find Misspoken Chicago on Facebook. You can find the podcast of Misspoken on iTunes and Stitcher. I recommend you do so. It is a wonderful thing. And by all means, get yourself to it. Find out more about the next one. What did you say? Last Wednesday of every month?
Yeah, it is going to be June 28th at the Gallery Cabaret in Bucktown. The theme is munchies. It is going to be a potluck. It is our third anniversary. We've been doing this for 3 years. So we are going to bring food and cupcakes. And we are going to have Lucy Nisley, Sarah Beacon, Nadine, Kenny Johnstone, and who I forgot the first time, sorry, Lauren Jordan.
There you go. Don't miss that. That's going to be super fun. Rosamund Lannan, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Come back anytime.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you very much. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thank you for sharing part of your Saturday evening with me. Always grateful to you for that. So, as ever, we have picked one big old topic and we are unpacking it piece by piece. We have been talking about the literary world of Chicago. We have talked about the history and great novels in the Chicago realm. We have talked about the Chicago Writers Studio and the importance of writerly community. And we have been talking about events that happen every single night of the week here in and around Chicago that are so very important and so vital to that community building aspect. And let us shift a bit now to genre specific conversation. We're joined now by author and journalist and speaker and all around fabulous person, Michelle Weldon, who is here with us in studio. She is the author of many, many things, but most recently her memoir Escape Points is her most recent one. She has talked about that on this very program, and she is going to be at the Printers Row Lit Fest tomorrow, so you don't want to miss her there. She will be at a signing from 2 to 4 in the Society of Midland Authors booth. Welcome back to the program, Michelle.
Hi, Amy. Great to be here.
Thank you for being with us. So when we talk about, we've talked about so many aspects of literature tonight, and we've, you know, hit many, many topics, but memoirs really your area that you do so much work in. And so When we think of memoir, I think a lot of people just kind of go, well, that's just telling your own story. That's just, you know, I think sometimes it almost gets a bad rap as like navel gazing, but it's really much more to that. What is memoir to you?
Well, as you said, it's far beyond navel gazing. Otherwise, that would just be typing.
Sure.
A chronological regurgitation of events like a ship's log or something. You know, I was today at Printer's Row and listened to Al Franken talk about his latest memoir. And boy, does he have a lot of ground to cover. And he was poignant and funny and irreverent and indignant and very touching and so humanistic. So that's what a great memoir is. It isn't about the totality of your life. It's about picking something about your life that could be edifying, uplifting, that you're extremely transparent about, that you're vulnerable about, and it's not just typing up your accomplishments.
Yeah.
It's really taking a good hard look in order, you know, not just for your own self-revelation, but to shine a light perhaps on a topic or on something that other people don't have the access to tell their stories, but who can relate to yours?
I think when memoir is done really well, it's when people say, oh my gosh, I'm not the only one. You know, when they start having this, oh my gosh, you've got to read this book. It's so much like this thing that happened to you that you told me about. It's like this, it's a strange, it's like a community building tool without even knowing the person telling the story almost.
Right. And even the specifics and the details of the event or the phase do not have to match your own. It's just the universal experience about it. I just read Ariel Levy's latest memoir. She's a New Yorker writer, and I certainly don't have her experience, and I won't spoil it, but do read it. And it is so remarkably well written and just raw and beautiful and vibrant and eloquent. And it just is awe-inspiring. And it connects you. When you read a story like that, that touches you on a very emotional, human level, it really enhances your own humanity and makes you more empathetic.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, your last book, Escape Points, when right after it came out, we had you right here in studio talking about it. And I admitted on the air, and I will do it again, that although I did not have that experience, it's so much about your role as a parent and your experience as a parent. By the fourth or fifth page, I had cried at least twice already because it was so touching. Even though I don't have children, I didn't have that experience. I still was just so moved by the storytelling and by the vulnerability in it. And I think that translates on a lot of topics. I mean, I'm thinking of books about you know, struggle and war and famine and addiction and all these things, other things I have not experienced, but that were so moving and that you leave with a greater understanding having read it.
That's right. I think when a good writer and a good memoirist writes to touch the audience, it's not writing from the head. It's writing from the heart. And that is so different. And that is a much different process because I can type all day long. And I actually do most days. But it's coming from a different place. I mean, when you know, you're reporting other things, you're writing journalism or you're writing posts or you're writing columns that don't really get to the heart of who you are or explaining something that means a great deal to you, it just comes from a different place. And when memoirists are good at that, I mean, to me, there's nothing better.
Yeah, yeah. And I think memoir holds an interesting spot in the literary realm because it's not necessarily going to, I mean, there's always going to be like an eat, pray, love kind of thing, but it's often like a sneaky victory. It's often not these big glossy books that have millions of dollars put behind them. It's a story that the readers spread like wildfire without these, you know, million-dollar PR budgets. It becomes this kind of like this special tool where people go, oh my gosh, you got to read this. You're going to feel so much. You're going to so identify. And it almost be kind of, it's like this perfect community building tool because the community spreads it for the author.
You know, and I like to think that's because the author is using his or her words. You know, we've been told that since we were children, you know, not to fight with each other, but to use your words. And when you think about that as a writer, if you really use your words to, you know, edify or elevate or highlight or illuminate something really important, that's a really good use of your words.
And so you are leading a workshop in this very thing, Enhancing the Creative in Creative Nonfiction. That's going to be at Northwestern Summer Writers Conference. And so when you have a room full of people, they're all there like, I got a story, which I believe everybody does have a story in them. But where do you start with that? I'm sure there's so many people with so many stories to tell, and you have a room full of people just dying to tell a story. What is the first step there in memoir?
Don't start from the beginning. I started out as a child.
Right.
My parents met at... So I tell people, you know, start with a surprise and focus in on one thing. You know, I've written two memoirs, and it's not because I think I'm so relentlessly interesting. It's that there were very specific things that I was delving into, and you can't cover it all. And just, you know, and maybe get advice from your friends about what is the most important part of your story, and get some feedback on what people want to hear about. And it's not necessarily the most salacious or the most popular or the most dramatic or the most intriguing, but what is the best story? And start there. And it could be starting at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But try and be surprising about what you discover for yourself in the writing, and therefore what the reader discovers in reading it.
Yeah, I think some memoirs that stick out to me, a lot of them have started with a moment of, oh my gosh. You know, I think of like Howard Lyman's book was given to me, and the first thing, he's in a hospital bed, he's having surgery the following morning, and he's sitting there like making deals with the divine. If I can manage through this, I will change my ways. And so right away you're going, okay, this is high stakes. This is serious. I'm thinking of like David Crosby's book, where the first thing is his intake form getting checked into prison and like how bad of shape he was in because of, and then he goes back to tell all these stories of rock and roll and drugs and all this stuff. So I think that's always kind of like the beginning of the end, or the end of the beginning, or, you know, those kind of pivotal moments seem
well,
important.
You know, not to genderize memoir, but it's really interesting, I think, the differences between women's memoir and men's memoirs. I mean, it tends to be, at least from what I've read and what I've seen, is men tend to write about their accomplishments, mm-hmm. or their big failures, or they're telling the stories like David Crosby, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And women tend to write about their fears and their shame.
Mm.
And I prepared by reading a thing from Adrienne Rich in her 1979 book on lies, secrets, and silence, where she wrote, "Women have often felt insane when cleaving the truth of our experience. Our future depends on the sanity of each of us, and we have a profound stake beyond the personal in the project of describing our reality as candidly and as fully as we can to each other."
Hmm.
So sometimes I'm reading books and or memoirs from women I greatly respect, like Mary Carr is another one, and Roxane Gay.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think, oh, I'm not crazy-ish.
Yeah. Right. I'm sort of maybe crazy in the same way as that person.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting, the different approaches. I mean, it's not, you know, strictly along gender lines, but it tends to be that way. That's why I find women's memoirs really illuminating and more satisfying as a reader.
That is a very, very good point. We're talking with Michelle Weldon. She's the author of many things, but most recently of a memoir called Escape Points. We'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Thank you. 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on this Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we pick one big topic and we talk about it all night. And tonight, that is the literary world of Chicago. And we have been talking about many, many aspects of that world. And right now, we're joined by Michelle Weldon, who is an author and a journalist and a speaker and all the things. She does lots and lots of things. You must Google her and you must go to her website, michelleweldon.com. That's Michelle with one L, and connect with her on social media to find out about all the cool things that she does. And so we've been talking about memoir, because that is a thing that you, you've written two memoirs and you teach a class about memoir. And so we were talking a little bit right before the break about kind of fighting the urge to put your entire life story into one book. And I think you are a unique person to illustrate that point, because you have two memoirs about two very, very different things. Even the time periods overlap a little bit in places, but they don't necessarily reference each other. They're very, very separate pieces. And I think that's an important point to make, that it's really just about this one aspect. And I think when you start thinking of that, that takes us out of this idea that memoir is selfish and is in fact very selfless and in fact very community building and very bonding for people.
Well, you know, the thing that's so paradoxical about that, Amy, is writing about yourself to be selfless.
Right.
I mean, it feels as if it's, you know, totally ego driven, but actually it's highly embarrassing, you know, and it's not that you want to say, look at me, look at me, look at me. It's learn from me.
Yeah.
And learn from my mistakes and possibly what I've been through and what I have learned maybe might save you or might make you feel understood. But it also isn't about being a savior, because there is real redemption in writing the truth. I think the greatest part about writing memoir, and I also write a lot of personal essays, is the truth-telling. It does set you free, and it can release you from lies and secrets and shame and letting it go, so you can understand it more fully and looking at it not just to you know, make yourself look better, because you might even look worse.
Sure.
If you're completely honest, it's just trying to be more fully aware.
Indeed. And I mean, thinking of like one that clearly has gone very far is Piper Kerman's book, Orange is the New Black. Look at what all has come out of her willingness to say, yeah, I went to prison and this is what happened. And, you know, look at how many people have now gotten into that program and read that book and hung on her every word of so much of her experience by being willing to say, yeah, I screwed up and I went to prison for it.
And yet the metaphor for that is so far beyond prison.
Yes.
Right. I mean, it's about sexuality and punishment and women relating to each other and about what we tell and what we don't tell and identity. And it's about so many different things. So it almost could take place anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, to have those issues. But yeah, it's kind of great that it's in a prison.
Right. That raises the stakes a little bit to have it right there in a prison.
Yeah.
Right. Definitely. Well, I think too, I'm really interested in what you said right before the break about the difference in memoirs written by men and written by women. And that is a really interesting distinction of how just kind of the approach is different. And as I, while we were on commercial, I was thinking of memoirs I have read by men and by women. And indeed, it is usually about a triumph of some sort. And it is a bit more confessional for women.
That's right. I mean, it doesn't always have to be about, you know, something's gone wrong and something I overcame and something really terrible and shameful. But women tend to not start in the middle, you know, where they're almost successful, and then look how great I am. So it's just an interesting kind of approach.
Yeah. And two, I think the role of the memoir, particularly written by women, is an interesting one, because often, you know, we kind of started down this road a little bit about the big publishing houses and kind of those big, the powerful storytellers that get like big PR budgets put behind them and that kind of thing. And yet it's like I don't want to say backdoor and downplay the significance of memoir, but it's like it's an alternate path that sometimes ends up way far ahead of where maybe women are not getting a seat at the table. And it's kind of this alternate path that puts you at the head of the table suddenly in a really interesting way.
But that doesn't always work that way.
Well, sure.
You know, they're not everyone has those
the slam
big
dunk
budgets.
With it. Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
And movies made out of their lives made into movies. But I mean, sometimes that's not even the point.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I do other things other than writing books, you know, to pay the mortgage. And it just is so satisfying as a writer to publish and have other people read. And it's also funny. Friends will say, or people I just meet at book signings or events will say, I bought your book and I lent it to, you know, all my friends. It's like, well, your friends could have bought a book.
They
didn't have to lend it.
Shell out 14 bucks for one, too.
So, I mean, the reach isn't really about the sales all the time. So you don't know the impact that you have.
But it seems that it, not sales at all. I think it's really about kind of this alternate path to voice.
That's right. And I think we're at a critical time right now in the culture where women's voices are silenced. I mean, if we look just at this week, I'm sure you saw that World Science Festival, that incredibly brilliant theoretical physicist, mm-hmm. which I can't even say three times in a row, much less be a theoretical
right.
physicist, Veronica Hubany, at the University of California, Davis, she was talked over about her expertise by not other physicists, but by the host, New Yorker journalist. And finally, a woman in the audience was so fed up with this brilliant physicist, female physicist, being spoken over at this all-male panel that she screamed, let her speak, please. And the place, you know, almost burst into flames. And that went viral on Facebook and many, many things were written about it. But I think that's kind of a great metaphor and also an extension of the she persisted
mm-hmm.
when, you know, Elizabeth Warren was shushed. And she persisted. And then, you know, Kamala Harris, she keeps talking. Who's she? So it's interesting at this time that women are supposed to be seen and not heard. And kind of women aren't standing for it anymore.
Yeah, we're kind of done with all that.
Yeah.
That's not really a thing we're willing to do right now.
Yeah.
And so you have something from one of your books with you. This is from Writing to Save Your Life, How to Honor Your Story.
That's right. I wanted to read this. I wrote this book back in 2001 and then updated it in 2012, but I love this part. In the Oscar-winning movie As Good As It Gets, there's a wonderfully well-written scene where Jack Nicholson is sitting in the back seat of a rental car that Helen Hunt is driving. Greg Kinnear is in the passenger seat, and the trio is on the road trip from hell to meet his parents so he can ask for money. Never mind that the deeper premise of the movie gives me the shivers. A young, funny, single mother falls for a creepy, hateful, age-spotty neurotic who is only civil when medicated. But in this one hilarious scene, they're all three in the car comparing life stories and musing that everyone must have had a bad childhood. Jack Nicholson vehemently disagrees. It's not true, he says. Some of us have great stories, pretty stories, that take place at lakes with boats and friends and noodle salad. Just not anyone in this car. He pauses. What makes it so hard is not that you had it bad, but that you're that pissed off that so many others had it so good. I don't think what motivates us to write about our lives and to feel a response to our words is an imaginary checklist comparing our histories with the lives of others, because we can never be as happy or fulfilled as the family across the street. We imagine they are not in their bedrooms at night crying, while they in turn are imagining we are not in our bedrooms crying. I don't think what creates our sadness, anger, or fear is the noodle salad at other people's picnics. It's how we see our own lives, whether or not we had pretty stories with noodle salad ourselves. We need to write our stories with or without noodles.
Excellent. I love that very much.
Thanks.
And that is from Writing to Save Your Life. I recommend that book very much. I have read it and enjoy it quite a bit. Well, friends, unfortunately, we are already running out of time. But tonight, lots of big themes have emerged, as ever, as they always do. So while we started talking about the literary world in Chicago, what quickly emerged from all of our guests is that we are in a diversely storied city, and those stories exist across many, many genres and platforms, and it behooves us to embrace and appreciate them all, and certainly to support them all around the city. So thank you to all of my guests, and thank you to Michelle Weldon, who will be at Printers Roulette Festival tomorrow, book signing 2 to 4. She will be in the Society of Midland Authors booth. Go in there and say hello. Buy that book. Get her to sign it. It'll be all good. And thanks for being with us tonight, Michelle.